This program is brought to you by Jewel, sous vide by Chef Steps. Jewel takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
Monday, December 3rd is our annual gala, Winter in the Garden, and you are invited. Celebrate the season with Heritage Radio Network at the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. It's the one night of the year where you can show your support for HRN while sipping on champagne, hanging out with our hosts, and bidding on one-of-a-kind silent auction items. VIP hour goes from 6 to 7, featuring a tour of the Bonsai Room. At 7, all of our guests can sample bites from some of our favorite chefs. Head to heritageradionetwork.org/gala for tickets.
Welcome to Why Food. This is your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
Why Food is the podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and creative people who have left behind former careers to join the food, beverage, and hospitality industry. This week, we're super excited to have Alex Mayasi, who's the editor at Gastro Obscura. He left college wanting to be a diplomat, and through a series of fortuitous events, has become a food editor and writer. So thank you for joining us, Alex.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So Alex, tell us how you got into food writing. You didn't start in food writing. You started your career as a different kind of journalist, but let's start with the transition into food and then we'll work our way back.
So when I first got really into journalism, I was doing mainly business and economic stories, although I had a lot of freedom to write about all sorts of different topics. I was at a media startup called Priceonomics in San Francisco, which in itself has quite an interesting backstory where when I first got there, it was kind of a classic tech startup where I was the third employee and it was very unclear what we were doing and we were pivoting from idea to idea. And it was a classic Silicon Valley experience before we kind of had this moment where we kind of realized like, no, we're journalists. We're trying to create a media company here. And so I think from one perspective, it could seem that I'm doing something very different. Before I did stories about marketing campaigns and cryptocurrencies and topics that feel very far from, cheese that is supposed to have live insects on it when you pull it out of its case. To give another example, a rare fusion food that resulted in a very particular diaspora. You know, those feel pretty distinct. But I think also from another perspective, and the one that hews closer to how I think about my writing and editing and my own career, they feel really in step with each other. So when I was doing more business and economics reporting, it was more in line with what you might hear or read in the context of Freakonomics or Planet Money. So I was doing, not as the stock market up or down, but I was doing stories about a famous marketing campaign that is responsible for the stereotypical association between Subarus and lesbians, which is a story in itself, and a story that I absolutely love and is a very endearing one. I think the two are kind of in step with each other because I've always enjoyed stories that are a bit more offbeat and more involve really finding a kind of story that is a little bit hidden. And so that's something that I did in business and economics reporting and something that I do now in food. So, they can be very different topics, but there's a way that I feel like I'm still doing the same thing.
Do you still remember the first food-related story that you wrote?
I think the very first I wrote... Oh, the very first food-related article I wrote was about the economics of food trucks.
Okay.
so this was at roughly peak food truck era. And I was in the Bay Area at the time at Priceonomics. And I think it was a lot of fun because at the time I didn't really, you know, this was before we really had the sense we were trying to start a media company. So it was kind of unclear. Am I a journalist here? What am I doing? I don't know. I'm just a person who's curious about food trucks. And I want to know, are the economics of food trucks better than restaurants? Should I expect food trucks to be taking over more and more? Like, who goes into this business? What are the benefits of it? And it was a lot of fun to just show up at food truck parks and ask people questions. And at the time, I was not familiar with any particular journalistic code of ethics. So when, after an hour of speaking with two brothers who ran a Thai food truck, said, hey, you want some pad thai? You want a Thai iced tea? And I was just like, yes, I do. there was no journalistic thought of, oh, I would have to pay you for that, which was a benefit at the time, I suppose. So that was my first food story.
What kinds of stories do you run at Gastro Obscura, and how does it tie into the larger mission of Atlas Obscura?
Yeah. So Atlas Obscura is a publication that's, our mission is really about making people experience wonder and just appreciate this amazing world that we all share. So we're both a publication that publishes lots of stories, and as well as a number of books, a growing number of books. We're also a company that does amazing events and that takes people on trips all over the world. And there are other media companies, of course, doing events or having different aspects of their business. But I think for Atlas Obscura, it really makes a lot of sense, and it's essential we're doing all those things, because we don't just want people to read a story or watch a video. We want people to be inspired to get out and do things. We want people to learn about an amazing place, whether that's on the other side of the globe or whether that's actually around the corner and they just had no idea that it's been there, or they didn't realize that there's some huge backstory to this building they've been walking by every day on their way to work. We want people to go out and see that place. We want people to get out and learn. We want people to go out and try foods that they learn about from Gastro Obscura. So Atlas Obscura is really about inspiring a sense of wonder and inspiring people to go out and do things and have great experiences.
And you started your writing career writing a book as well. Can you talk to us about that and how that kind of happened?
Sure. So that's going backwards in time. To 2011, 2012, when I was living in Cairo, Egypt, and it was a particular time to be in Egypt. So I arrived shortly after the Arab Spring started, and shortly after the Egyptian Revolution, which toppled the dictator who had ruled the country for 30 years, Hosni Mubarak. I think I arrived in classic young recent grad style, full of optimism and with this sense of mission that I was there inspired by all these people who had risked their lives for democracy and freedom, and those words were really important, and really everyone there really tangibly felt what they meant. And so when I had been in a college, I'd graduated in 2011, I had been studying international relations, I had spent some time in the Middle East, been very interested and intrigued by just the way that when you're there, it felt like anything could change at any moment. It felt very dynamic. I had some family connection to the region as well, which deepened my interest. And so I had been intending to continue learning Arabic with the goal of perhaps one day becoming a diplomat. And, you know, then halfway through my last year of college, the revolution started, the Arab Spring started, and moving to Cairo, it felt a bit like moving to Berlin after the Berlin Wall felt, you know, something like that, where it felt like this could be a kind of huge shift. And I had some, you know, all these nice optimistic sentiments about imagining, you know, 30 years later, after a career in diplomacy or foreign affairs, there could have been so much progress in the region that you kind of get on a train in Morocco, go through the Middle East, and you end in, you know, in Israel. And it's, you know, you're not going constantly through checkpoints, but it's a very easy journey, and you're stopping and seeing friends all the way along the way. So when I was planning to move to Cairo, I was introduced to an Egyptian democracy activist, a man named Ahmed Salah. A really amazing, admirable guy who had played a pretty unusual role, because a lot of activists are they're often, I think, you know, they're usually not people who are traveling the world, often people who kind of in the early stages when a revolution seems impossible in a police state, in a place that's really repressive. This is certainly not universally true, but a lot of the people making up the brunt of a very nascent activist movement are working class or poor people who maybe don't have as many as much to lose or as many assets to be targeted or really feel more tangibly the need for change. And so Ahmed was a very unusual figure in that he had been born into a kind of politically elite family. He had family members who had been high-ranking in the government. If I'm remembering correctly, one of his uncles was one of a very small number of military officers who led the 1952 revolution in Egypt. And so he was someone very well-educated from a very prominent family, and yet he was someone who was part of these very prominent person, these nascent democracy movements, just spending years just getting beaten up on the street, threatened by the police, and just putting themselves on the line when there was, everyone just thought it was crazy to hope for democracy the way that they did. And so part of him being this unusual figure was that he kind of assumed this almost unofficial role as a representative of Egypt's democracy activists to the world, almost like he was their ambassador. So he would go to Washington, D.C. and meet members of Congress and speak before Congress and meet secretaries of state and, you know, kind of say, I know you're going to still support our dictator no matter what, but if you could maybe give him a few less weapons or, well, okay, you're always going to give him weapons, but maybe you could, I believe what he would kind of, you know, say is, you know, we'd appreciate it if you were, you know, when we're getting beaten up in the street, if you maybe say some things that would cause the Egyptian government to reconsider and give us some space to work in. And so as a result of him being someone who was in D.C. or New York or European capitals, he met some of the political science, international relations professors who I studied with in college. And so when I was planning to move to Cairo, a professor introduced us and said, Ahmed is looking for help writing a book, and you're going to Egypt. And so that's how I got started in that project.
And you said that writing that book and interviewing him and spending was 4 years with him kind of changed and shaped how you approach stories and approach storytelling now. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. I think my own inclinations in writing, I get very interested in systems or kind of a specific question I want to answer. And this is something that really came out when I was writing more often about business and economics. I wanted to know why did something work this way? Even if it was something just like, you know, why can I get free Wi-Fi in a $15 hostel? No problem. But if on a rare occasion when I'm at, you know, in the suite of a nice hotel, I have to pay for the Wi-Fi. Like, why is that? So I love those types of stories. I love having a question that I want to answer. But I also think there's a reason that so many journalists, newspaper writers, they're always looking for a person who represents the story or who's, you know, they're always looking for someone to tell the story. And that's because I think it's more common for people to appreciate storytelling when it's really embodied through someone who's relatable, a kind of main character or protagonist. And so having this long-running project, which you alluded to it taking 4 years, that's not because we wrote 10,000 pages. That's because working with you know, a penniless democracy activist in a police state comes with its own unique sets of challenges, and we face some different setbacks that resulted in it being published a bit later than we might have liked. But don't regret it at all. But you know, spending a lot of time talking to one person to learn his story, it really gave me a lot of appreciation for the power of having a compelling protagonist and telling a story about one person and having a main character. And I think that's something I think about now when I get a pitch and like a lot of editors, I might ask a writer, you know, who could be the main character in this story or, you know, who are we gonna talk to? And potentially getting excited when it seems like we have a character who, you know, they've had an experience that's really a story. You know, they face some sort of problem or challenge and you know, they face the kind of the classic plot that you think about when you're thinking with a novel or a movie. You know, you have a main character, there was a big challenge they faced, and, you know, there's a climactic moment when they resolve it. And those are always really exciting stories, and I think it was a, you know, benefit to have my first formative experience with writing, even if it was a completely intentional one. I was not intending to have that launch me towards journalism. I think it was very helpful for that to be one where I spent a lot of time digging into one person's story and seeing the power of that and how there's kind of always more to figure out about one person and his or her story.
How hard is it to find that protagonist in food stories, where often it's not an individual who's invented something or created something, that you're talking about a larger trend, or you're talking about a dish that's typical to a specific cuisine? How do you find the person to wrap the story around?
That's interesting. I mean, you know, at Gastro, we're more often, you know, not every story is a long story that's the equivalent of, you know, a cover story for a magazine article. So, you know, it's only every once in a while when we're looking for a kind of a story that's really driven by a protagonist. So, you know, you don't need to force that. I mean, you can never force that. I think it's more often that you're just asking, who do we talk to? How do we get voices in the story? How do we hear from the people affected? And I don't think that's terribly challenging, but it is really satisfying when you get someone who kind of went through this experience, and there was like a rising action and climax and resolution in classic plot fashion. But I think those are the ones that's kind of in the pitch or not. You don't just find that after the fact, I don't think, so often.
Speaking of different topics at Gastro, I mean, you talk a lot about this kind of sense of wonder. I'm sure you get a lot of pitches, and I'm sure a lot of those writers feel all of their pitches have that sense of wonder. Like, how do you parcel out what you think is really going to, a story and a writer accompanying that story that's going to make it shine and, like, kind of worthy of the publication?
Yeah, I don't think it's unique to Alice Obscura. Like, we do ask ourselves, what exactly does wonder mean? How do we explain that to people who are interested in writing for us? And how do we, you know, make sure when we're a publication trying to write about, have stories that take place all over the world, how do we make sure that, you know, we escape from some traps where we might think something is really unusual or unique, but that's just because we're in Brooklyn, and you know what seems really unusual to us is pretty workaday in, you know, another spot that we're less familiar with. But yeah, I think, you know, at every publication you have this question of kind of, you know, someone can pitch something that just feels right for the publication, and what's the difference between what you say yes to and what you end up passing on. And so I think when I'm more often talking with people, with a writer about is, you know, if you explain this story to one of your friends, like, do you get a smile? Do you get a reaction? 'Cause I think, you know, some of the most popular stories I've ever written or that I've been part of as an editor or just talked with a fellow writer about, you know, there are exceptions, but usually, like, you just share the idea and people are just, you know, people are reacting right away. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I think that's often when you know you have something, when people are reacting, whether it's smiling, laughing, incredulity, just asking questions because they want to know more. That's, I think, a good sign across journalism. And I think it's especially important when what you're going for in is wonder, that, you know, there's some aspect of it that's just hard to define. But I think there's also an element that, you know, if it's something that when you share, people should be, you get that reaction, you know, that's definitely a sign that you're on the right track.
What's been the most interesting part of the transition for you personally from being a writer to now being an editor? And what have you learned about your own writing from spending so much time with other people's work?
I learned that my own writing was too long. I don't know if that's shocking, since I was someone always working in digital where the page can keep extending forever, and someone who wasn't really classically edited in the way that someone would if they, you know, got started at a newspaper or a magazine. You know, I was someone at this startup that kind of morphed into a media publication. So I was more self-taught myself. So I've definitely learned that my writing was too long, helping dozens of people every month cut down their own writing. Has certainly led me to appreciate all the times that I didn't do that to my own writing. So I think I would hope that I've grown more concise, at least after a few more attacks on what I've just written. Let's see. I mean, I think it's given me just a lot of appreciation for a lot of appreciation for really good editors as I've grown into the role, but also I think, yeah, just appreciation for the coaching element of it, especially when you're working not just on one piece, but you're working with, say, a staff writer or someone who you're a regular contributor, so someone you're gonna keep working with, and just the potential to give lots of feedback and keep figuring out the like writer-editor relationship, and help them figure out exactly what will work for the publication and how to improve their own writing. I think, you know, that's something that I've grown to appreciate a lot more, and am now incredibly appreciative of the times when I have worked with a really good editor.
I receive this question a lot on the culinary school end, so I'm also curious what you think about formal training within the writing sphere. Like, is it worth it to go to school for writing, or can you learn everything on the job?
Yeah, I think I've always wondered myself, I know it's a big question for young writers, whether they should go to journalism school. And I know not so long ago when I was mulling that question, especially mm-hmm. since I had not been, you know, formally trained or worked with a professional editor, but had come from this kind of unusual background, it was very much on my mind. I can definitely say by far the most, I mean, I could basically not find, I couldn't find someone who said it was a good idea, who really recommended going to journalism.
Really? Okay.
School, which felt very sad to me, because I was like, I like school, I like learning, that seems like it would be great. I'm sure I would have benefited from journalism school.
What are the main critiques?
I mean, just cost is certainly one, considering that, sure. you know, the financial rewards for the majority of people to be in a journalist have gone down, but mm-hmm. the cost of journalism school has not. So that's certainly part of it. I'm a little more, you know, spitballing here rather than quoting people who was giving me advice, but I think, you know, part of it too is just the sense that, you know, there isn't quite as much, it's a little bit more wild in the journalism world than kind of the gatekeepers here and here. So I think some of the value of networking at a top journalism school aren't quite there, but by the same token, I feel like I've worked with young writers who have come to us out of a great journalism program, and they just know a lot about how to write well, and they recognize, even if they haven't gotten down how to implement everything yet, they have a really good awareness of, you know, intangibles about like what a nut graph is, which, you know, I learned what a nut graph is far later than I'd like to admit. A nut graph being, you know, that kind of paragraph where you really state what the article is going to be about. And so, you know, I have a hard time imagining, I mean, they're talented people. I'm sure they would have found their way if they'd taken a different path, but I have a hard time imagining that they didn't benefit from, you know, all these really great writers and editors they got to learn from. And I know they're writers, you know, it would be a regular occasion for me to read a great magazine story, and, you know, at the bottom it says that so-and-so is a professor at the Columbia Journalism School. I'm like, well, that'd be great to talk with that person, because, like, I was crying from this story. Yeah. It was so good.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 2 minutes with Alex Mayassi from Gastro Obscura.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I am the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is intuitive to use and preloaded with all the recipes you'll need, and it has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for holiday cooking. It's easy to cook for a crowd, and it's perfectly precise, so you can focus on entertaining without worrying about checking food temps, while Jewel does all the work. You can try out new cuts fearlessly. One of the best things I ever made sous vide was a juicy, tender heritage goose with juniper berries, and it was life-changing. And pro tip, Jewel is small and packs easily, so you can sneak it along on your holiday travels to be this season's food hero everywhere you go. With Jewel, you get perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code HRN. And happy holidays from all of us at Team HRN.
And we're back with Alex Mayassi, the editor of Gastro Obscura. We were talking about some of the really cool work that Alex has done in his career prior to coming to Gastro Obscura. Tell us what's next. What direction are you taking the website?
Oh, well, it's funny. We were talking a little bit before the show that, when I was first talking to people at Atlas Obscura about joining and becoming the editor of Gastro Obscura and launching Gastro Obscura. It's something that Gastro Obscura has been around for just over a year now. I was someone who'd like written, a number of food articles that I was super excited about, and I would happily talk about how a dictator more or less invented pad thai like all day. But I was someone who a lot of my clips and experience writing and editing was business and economic stories. And so, I certainly leaned into that fact. I think I'm someone who absolutely loves food stories, but I'm also someone who might pick up a food publication and actually find relatively little in there that's of interest to me. Mm-hmm. And not because they're badly written or that was a bad issue, but just because a lot of food publications are tailored for people who, say, want lots of recipes because they're cooking all the time. And I enjoy cooking, but I don't need 10 new recipes every week. That's well beyond my capacity. Yeah. And I'm not someone who necessarily is particularly interested in knowing about the fact that cauliflower is the trendy vegetable this year.
It's not
this year, I guess, but if we go back a couple of years or I'm happy to hear about what's going on in LA or New York cooking scene, top restaurants, but that's not something I'm particularly compelled to follow. And so there are definitely food publications that, they'll have some stories that I feel professional jealousy of. I'm like, oh, I wish I wrote that, or I wish I was the one who assigned that for Gastro Obscura now that I'm in this position. But I think it's definitely the case that a lot of my favorite pieces of food journalism that I've ever read have appeared in more general interest publications, and a lot of them are written by people who are not professional food writers. Some are and some aren't. And I think that's because, and so that's more what I wanted, and what we do at Gastro Obscura, I think, is, the type of food writing that you don't have to be a foodie, you don't have to be someone who's cooking all the time, reading Gastro Obscura will not keep you up to date on food trends and what's going on in the top culinary scenes. Instead, it's, stories that, like we talked about before, inspire a sense of wonder and curiosity. And that's happening through food. We did not invent the idea of food being a great lens to talk about all sorts of other topics and issues, but it's something that we love to do.
What are some of the stories that you're most excited about, or the the nuggets of awareness or exploration that you get the most excited about?
Yeah, I think a story that I helped edit and that we published a few months ago gets at the both what Gastro Obscura does and also Atlas Obscura's mission of getting people out to explore and experience things. So we ran a story by a writer named Mark Hay, which was about Koryo Saram food. And so Koryo Saram food, it's something that's gotten some press before. There's a very nice New York Times profile of a local restaurant that has Koryo Saram food. But like, it's only in New York City where you are going to have a local review of a Koryo Saram restaurant. Koryo Saram are a very small group of people, ethnic Koreans from mainly Uzbekistan. And so, you know, it's this interesting fusion food of Korean, Uzbek, Russian, or Uzbek Central Asian more generally. And, you know, I think people are just intrigued and want to try that type of food. But then it has this really compelling, tragic backstory where the Koryo Saram, if you kind of go back about 100 years, they were ethnic Koreans living just to the north of Korea, so in what was, you know, then Russia. If you fast forward a bit, the kind of short version of the story is that Stalin was convinced that these ethnic Koreans could not be trusted in the event of a upcoming war. He worried that they would be spies or unreliable. And so he deported each and every one to what's, you know, modern day Uzbekistan, a few other parts of Central Asia.
How did he choose Uzbekistan as the destination?
I think, I don't know exactly. I think it's just though that like, it's very far away, you know, like they would be far from Korea. And it's just, you know, it was just kind of, I mean, Stalin was somewhat infamous for just moving massive amounts of people around due to these types of concerns. And I mean, no small amount of racism in this case. And so, you know, these people were just kind of the conditions of moving there was, you know, it was all at once. It was sudden. It was dangerous. You know, transit was not comfortable. And they were just dropped in this unfamiliar place. I believe Stalin also hoped that I think some of these transits also were done to, they would kind of move people to kind of frontier areas that they wanted to develop. So they were hoping that these, you know, they'd help with local farming and developing the area. So, you know, these people just dropped in a completely unfamiliar place. But, you know, over time they, you know, there was a mix of, you know, becoming integrated and also keeping their own traditions, and you have this interesting fusion food develop. And so, you know, it's a really interesting story to hear about the history. But then also, you know, when I was editing the story, I was like, well, I want to go try the food. And so I, you know, biked down towards Coney Island, where there are two Koryo Saram restaurants, in that area. And I went to one, and it was just like, I had,
which one did you go to?
It has several different names. I think, if I'm correctly, Eddie's Fancy Food is one of them and perhaps the most memorable. And yeah, I biked down there, and it was just, I think the kind of exact experience I associate with Atlas Obscura of getting people to go out and try something they might never find out about otherwise. It's a very unassuming restaurant. And I think, you know, it was me and one other Russian man in there when I was eating, and, you know, it was just food, that I'd never tasted before. And it was really, you know, I like talking about that story because it's one where it was both a really compelling story, but also kind of a prompt and a thrust to go out and try something new and find someplace.
And what do they speak? Not at the restaurant, like in when the ethnic group was living in Russia, do they speak Russian?
Yeah, so there's a lot of adoption of Russian, I think, both, you know, assertively and also, as happens in these cases, of, you know, some level of, you know, the Russian government trying to, you know, integrate people more forcefully. So you often see that coming out in terms of the, you know, policies at schools about what language is spoken and the education there. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. So I also want to talk about for people who want to go into food writing, who might be have written a little bit before, kind of advice on people who want to break into food writing, how to frame their stories, how to pitch you and other editors so that it feels compelling, it feels interesting, and can, you know, eventually get more and more of their pieces into various publications.
Yeah. So probably one place to start is that it can be difficult to figure out how to even pitch a story, I recognize. So I think don't be dissuaded. Go figure out. Like, usually there are pitch guidelines somewhere. Ours are floating around on Google Docs that are, you know, made available in various places. But definitely, don't be afraid to ask, you know, tweet at, talk to people you know, look around for sites that are resources for writers, or if it comes down to it, like, tweet a writer who you think is great and be like, how does, you know, where you wrote for this place? Like, how do you do, you know, where, what is the pitch email? Because I think those can often be hidden. I've had that my own experience, even once I was fairly into journalism, of just like, I don't know where to find their guidelines. This is surprisingly hard.
What about responses? And if you hear no's, what should you do?
Yeah, I think, you know, some people are naturalists at this, others aren't. I was not. You have to be aware that hearing no is like the expected response. If 50% of your pitches were accepted, you're a rock star.
Yeah.
You're doing fantastic. You'll see regularly or hear accounts from very successful writers where they talk about, writing a story that was nominated for all sorts of prizes, and then they pitch the same editor again, and it gets rejected quite quickly. That happens all the time. You know, it's maybe helpful to think a little bit more, like, you were pitching movies to like a Hollywood producer. Like, they're, you know, it's not going to work out every time. You know, not everything gets made into a Hollywood blockbuster. Journalism isn't quite that hard, but in terms of, you know, how many pitches you need to do, but you definitely, it's helpful to know, like, that's going to happen. Even to the best, you're going to hear no. You need to know that there are a lot of reasons for why you might have heard no. It's not necessarily that it's a bad idea. There are all sorts of different reasons but also sometimes that's helpful if someone says no, because they might have recognized, for a reason you haven't quite grasped yet, why the story is not right. So, you know, it could be right for a different publication. We also all have ideas that don't turn out, and it's actually helpful if you get to discard the ones that aren't going to work out. It saves you time.
What kinds of pitches do you like to see? What do you respond to? Not respond literally, like, respond to the email, but like, what gets you going?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I know when a pitch just, like, maybe like we were talking about before, like, when it makes me react, you just notice that immediate reaction. And so, you know, it's hard to say, like, you know, that's different every time. It depends on the story. But I think some kind of actionable advice on that is, I know if you are trying to pitch a story, you want to do freelance writing, you're often kind of gonna grab, you know, the first idea you have, and then look for a publication that you think might feasibly want it. And that might work, but I think a lot of the time it can be a mistake to too quickly pitch a publication. Because especially if you haven't worked with anyone at that publication before, you know, it's unlikely that the first pitch you thought of is going to be the one that's going to make them, you know, on a day when they're looking through 10, 20 pitches, say, like, yes, this is the one I want, and I want to give this person money, and I want to invest a bunch of my time, mm-hmm. Working with this person. So I know I've made that mistake before, and definitely, I think when you're sending a pitch email, especially to an editor you've never worked with before, you kind of want to be bouncing on the edge of your seat a little bit in excitement. Like, that's how you, like, you have that feeling in your gut. Like, this is a great story. Like, when I tell my friends about it, you know, over a beer, like, they keep asking more and more questions. And, you know, especially for something like Gastro, where we're going for something that's a bit hidden and has, you know, inspires wonder in people, it should, you know,
it should inspire wonder in people. You know, I think it can be easy to just want to do a story. And so you kind of grab the first thing and you'll end up pitching, you know, it's a lot more effective to, you know, pitch a few great stories that you're really excited about rather than, you know, 10 times as many stories that are kind of okay.
Can you sense that excitement in the email? Does the way that they write the pitch, is that telling for you, or are you really focused on the idea?
Yeah, I mean, you can tell. Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, you know, you'll get excited about the idea, but also, I've had that experience of, you know, working with someone and they're writing about something like genuinely interesting, and you're like, it just really feels like you're phoning it in. Can you not, like, why don't, you know, like, this isn't, you know, journalism is, we're not being paid like investment bankers. Like, if you're not having fun, why are we here? Like, you should, you should enjoy this. So yeah, that definitely comes through with people's writing. And, you know, if you're a writer and we had a staff writer at Ellis Obscura who wrote like two versions of an article. Like, one was like a standard write-up of this interesting, piece of research. And then she wrote the exact same article in like rhyming Seussian verse.
Why?
And like, just cause like that's who she is. And cause it was fun. It made sense for the story too. I think there's a kind of like Seussian element to the story. But you know, I mean, I think I wouldn't necessarily recommend like pitching everything in verse all the time, although I would remember it probably. But I think like you always sense that excitement, like, you know, and that's a lot of the best writers are known for the fact that they get people like super interested in a pile of wood chips or whatever thing doesn't seem like it would be interesting to you. But then, you know, someone's just really excited about it and like takes you on this trip to tell you about it. So that comes through.
What about just like developing your voice, and as you've grown as a writer yourself and an editor too, how have you kind of seen your writing change, seen your voice change and how you write, and how would you recommend like helping people who are up and coming to find a better and closer representation of themselves through their writing?
I think a piece of feedback I find myself giving often to young writers, and that many editors give to young writers, is that I know, like something I did when I was younger was that I was always trying to be really writerly. So I think, you know, when I'm writing something, you know, there's always a turn of phrase, or I'm not good at puns, but I know a lot of writers, they're just putting puns everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of always trying to phrase everything in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. And it's then for the reader, it's exhausting. You know, it's like if you were an interior decorator and you just put like sparkles on everything and everything was gold.
Yeah.
And you know, now like you're Trump's interior decorator, and it's just, you walk in the room and it's just overwhelming and you're uncomfortable. And it's too bad, cause you put all this effort into it, and like you are, you know, it's great when people can be clever in their writing. But I think, you know, it's very helpful to realize that you don't have to put so much effort into like every turn of phrase, and to realize the power of actually mainly focusing just on the idea or the story and then telling it really clearly. Because that's really where the power comes from, is finding a really compelling story or really interesting idea. And, you know, that's a lot of editing, is taking away everything that's not the story. And then, you know, once you're focused on just finding something that is really compelling, explaining it clearly, then you can have some fun with the writing, and then you're not stressed because you're trying to carry the story just on the weight of being really clever with the writing and having metaphors and puns. And you know, then if you have a great idea and you've told it clearly, then your pun or your clever turn of phrase will be like just, you know, tasteful interior decorating. It'll be having like one chair in the corner with a pop of color, and it'll be nice and not overwhelming.
In the last few minutes of the podcast, we're going to transition into our rapid fire segment, which sometimes we forget to do, but we did not forget to do it today.
Excellent.
So we're just going to throw a bunch of funny, wonky questions at you and see what happens. Jenny, you want to start?
How do you like your eggs in the morning?
Oh, I probably shouldn't admit this, but I often... I often microwave my eggs just as a time saver. And so I don't have to do more dishes.
Do you microwave them in the shell, or like you crack them open and you microwave them?
Crack them in a bowl.
Well, if you microwave them in the shell, they explode.
Oh, I've never done this. They do?
Isn't this a thing? I think you also have to break the yolk. If you microwave a whole yolk, it explodes. The liquid inside.
Well, now I want to try this even more.
We should try
it. I have yet to explode an egg in the microwave.
Do you have a technique, or what's your microwave egg recipe?
Yeah, how many seconds do you microwave the egg?
Oh, I first put it in for 53 seconds, then give it a second, and then like another 23 seconds.
Okay.
I think if you just do it all in one go, then you get some explosions.
We're so fascinated by this answer because we've asked this question many times, and it's always like scrambled, over easy.
Yeah, as you can tell, I've embraced my role as like someone who moved into a food editor role without the food background. And so, you know, there's a question like, do I pretend that I'm always like eating fabulously and in a sophisticated manner? And you know, plenty of great food people aren't being sophisticated about food all the time. But no, it's like I'm gonna embrace. Yeah, yeah, like I can tell people like, yeah, I microwave eggs. It saves time. I like then sometimes on weekends, like leisurely making eggs and putting goat cheese on it that melts just a little bit, and it's great. But
so there's your food writer bona fides, your slow scrambled eggs with goat cheese, but mostly it's just microwaved. What's the best meal you've ever had for under $10 or $5?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Koryo Saram restaurant I referenced before, I believe, was under $10. And I, you know, it's one of the few meals at a restaurant that I've eaten in bike shorts. So I think that fits with the general thrust of the question of a rather informal, inexpensive setting.
What did you eat?
Let's see. I had a fish dish that had a nice mix of, like spicy and cool flavors. I had a soda that I'm forgetting the name right now. Tarkan soda, I believe, which is bright green, which is really exciting.
One of the tarragon.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got that kind of licorice flavor. And I mean, the green's really just from food dye, but like it is exciting. Yeah. I got excited.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
So I kind of got frustrated. I've been thinking about this for like 5 years.
This question? No.
Kind of. Just the fact that like, you know how you'll be, someone wants to make small talks. They say like, if you had to choose a superpower, what would it be? Or, you know, would you rather be able to fly or be invisible? And by far, maybe you've had a different experience than me, like almost everyone says flight over invisibility.
I just want to teleport. I don't want to do any flying.
Okay.
Flying's too much work.
Just no need for the rest of you to listen to the rest of this. But right, like so many people say, I would want to be able to fly. It just really bothers me because I realize like there are, like you can fly. And I don't just mean like you can go in an airplane. I mean like hang gliding and paragliding, like you can learn to fly, and it is like you are using your own effort and you're like practically flapping wings. Like you can learn to fly, and like none of us do it. And it's crazy, kind of crazy and bonkers to me. And so I feel like this has bothered me for years. So I feel like I would choose being able to master like hang gliding overnight.
What food do you feel like most represents your childhood in your memories?
Oh, macaroni and cheese. I ate a lot of macaroni and cheese.
Was it Kraft macaroni and cheese?
Yes. Oh, no, Annie's. Sorry.
Annie's.
Yeah, a lot of Annie's.
Like white cheddar shells.
Yeah, exactly. And ate a lot of that like with my best friend underneath the table, which is, you know, the lazy child's fort.
Excellent. Well, Alex, it's been such a pleasure having you. Tell our listeners where they can find you. And if they're interested in pitching, where would they email their pitches to?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on Twitter at Amayasi. Also happy for you to communicate with me there. Ask me about pitching or other things. Love working with new writers. Would love to hear from folks. You can also find the pitch guidelines for Atlas Obscura and Gastro Obscura in our FAQ section on our website, and the email address for pitching Gastro.
And the website is?
It's atlasobscura.com/gastro.
Great.
Well, thank you again for coming. And you can always find us at Why Food Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And if you have nominations or questions or thoughts, please email us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks to our awesome engineer, Matt Patterson, and to the creators of our theme song, a band called The Red Crickets.
And the song is Blind.
Thanks.
See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.